Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and we all raided Sawyer's old stash and split it up, and I got a copy of Watership Down.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I raided Sawyer's stash while he was out on a raft trying to save us all. But I have no regrets because I stole all his sunscreen, so my Irish skin will not be lobster red on the beach.
And I'm Neil Miller, and while Sawyer was out losing his glasses, I stole from his stash a copy of Booty Babes. Big, bouncy, beautiful buns.
Mm-hmm.
In Neil's defense, I kind of made him pick that answer. So, like, don't get if you have a.
I stole his porn. Okay, I stole his porn.
It's the thing he missed the most.
He's not going to need it because his glasses are gone. So,
no, that's a good point. Well, that's the nice part about big booty babes is you kind of don't need super sharp definitions.
They're glasses proof.
Exactly. We're here to discuss The Long Con, season 2, episode 13. Of Lost, if this is your first time joining us, we are Lost Rewatch Podcast, the ABC series Lost. It aired for 6 seasons. We're doing a rewatch. We split the podcast into 2 different sections. The first section, the lengthier section, it's called The Calm. It'll be focusing on this episode, The Long Con, and all the episodes that came before it without using any knowledge that we gained in later episodes or in weird ARGs and a whole bunch of stuff happened around season 2 of Lost back in 2006. But we're not going to talk about any of that in The Calm because we have a whole separate section for that, the latter half part of our podcast. I want to say half after saying one is lengthier. That's just dumb. The second part of our podcast is called The Storm. It's for a storm of spoilers where we take all the facts we know about Lost and apply it to this episode. That way we have something for everybody. If we have something that we're providing for you and you like us so much that just listening to this podcast for free isn't doing it for you, you can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. Not only will you be able to subscribe for a dollar amount at a monthly fee and be able to get support us, you'll be getting some special content that we make just for you and getting access to our Slack, the nicest place on the internet, a place where we talk about who we want to kiss on Lost so much that it's going to actually become part of the actual podcast this week, and where last weekend we watched Ever After with our friends down in the Slack. It's a nice Drew Barrymore movie that was shot on 35mm, and it's great to see some movies shot on film that are set in just generic Europe. Anyway, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, that's where you could support the show, but you don't have to give us money to talk back at us. We have lots of ways to get a hold of us and to use your participation in the show, and that's what Joanna does right here.
Yes, so you can write us an email, tweet at us, leave a review. I'm going to hit a few of those right now, but just so you know, if you want to write an email to us, you're going to want to write it to host@stormpodcast.com. That's host@stormpodcast.com. We've gotten some great discussion around the character of Charlie, and we will have another email about Charlie. I was like, initially I was going to be like, let's not talk about Charlie again. But then like, Charlie's got his hood up this episode. He's doing stuff. So we got to keep talking about Charlie. Anyway, we'll get to that in a second. First, I'm going to read a review that we got. And if you want to drop us a review on iTunes, we really, really do appreciate it. This one is called, it's literally the only new review we got, so I do have to read it, but it's called Amazing Show and Joanna is the goat. And it's by the Lullabadir. I'm going to say the Lullabadir. That's what I'm going to say. And they write, I've listened to the show since their Game of Thrones days, and I love the dynamic between the three co-hosts. I've been considering starting a rewatch of Lost for a while, and their change of subjects was the perfect prod in that direction. The thoroughness with which they cover each episode is very thoughtful, and their banter along the way is so charming and engaging. And the work that Joanna puts in, from bringing in current and past internet discourse on the show to to contributing well-considered and delightful interviews with creators and contributors to the series and the conversations around it, cannot be understated. Great show. So glad to hear my faves talk about one of my faves. So thank you for those nice words. I appreciate them. All right. And in terms of emails, yeah, we have one spoiler email that I am going to talk about in the storm. I think sometimes I promise that and I don't deliver, but this one is about Libby and definitely belongs in the storm. So we're going to put a Libby email in the storm, but the Charlie email is going to chill out here in the calm. This one's from Casey. And Casey says, like the listener who wrote in last week, I'm also a sober alcoholic with several years in sobriety / recovering. And after watching Fire Plus Water a few months ago, I realized I wanted to write you guys about the way in which Charlie's terrible behavior in season 2, so irritating when I first watched Lost 10 years ago before I got sober, actually strikes me as completely realistic. And that I think the writers might have unintentionally stumbled into pretty accurate writing of what I'd term an addict without a program. I agree with everything in the email the listener who wrote in before. Basically, drug and alcohol addiction can be thought of as a pattern of self-centered extreme thinking that creates an intense amount of mental distress for the addict who uses alcohol and or drugs or sex or gambling or shopping or food to escape from that thinking. Many recovery programs would predict that if you simply remove the alcohol or drugs but don't treat the self-centered thinking, the addict will likely still be intensely unhappy. In AA, we refer to this as a dry drunk. Not drinking, but still extremely restless, irritable, and discontent, taking innocent developments in his life and turning them into huge personal affronts to his ego with no real consideration for the fears and concerns of others. Watching Fire Plus Water and The Long Con were very affecting for me to rewatch because they throw Charlie's untreated addict behavior into particularly sharp relief. Charlie's behavior is textbook untreated dry addict in both the island, on both the island where he's fear spiraling mentally because of the increased distance from Claire, then starts a huge unnecessary conflict with Locke. When he ignores concerns for Aaron's safety because his ego is under threat, then escalates that conflict with Locke into deception, manipulation, and violence to humiliate him. And also in the flashback where he cannot at all process Liam's decision to go to rehab as a supportive brother and is instead entirely concerned with what about me fears. As difficult as the behavior is to watch, actually I say his season 2 behavior strikes me as the most realistic of his arc on Lost. With the quitting heroin cold turkey because of a moth sticking out as the truly, I think I misread that. Anyway, basically season 2 is the most realistic. And then Casey writes, if the show had argued that the island's magical healing powers were at play here, the thing that healed Locke's injury, and some other things possibly, but the writers didn't go in that direction. And in my opinion, in general, don't explore Charlie's addiction in a level of detail that is rewarding for the character or audience. It's almost as if the character of Charlie was written by two writers in the writer's room, one anonymously sober addict who slips in little nuggets that make Charlie's behavior somewhat realistic without being too explicit, and then a writer who knows nothing about addiction at all and wants to write a standard network primetime storyline peppered with sci-fi twists. Whether it's through a 12-step program or a super sciencey psychology-focused recovery program that teaches 12-step lessons without the spiritual language, the cure for addiction is connection with other people and with a purpose greater than oneself that gets the addict out of his own head. Blah, blah, blah. There's some spoiler stuff here that I'm trying to dodge around, which is why me reading this is so dicey. Casey concludes by just saying, I'm fascinated to rewatch Jack's journey as well. Jack has always been my favorite on the show. I have way too much sympathy, affection for him, given his often terrible behavior. And now I have a better understanding of why, having gotten through some of the later stuff. So, all right. So that's from Casey. And sorry if that was a slightly stumbly reading. I both do not have my glasses on and was trying to duck and weave spoilers in real time. So I apologize for the diciness of that. But I think that that is an interesting thing to think about. And Casey wrote a follow-up email where she said she listened to our podcast last week and she agrees with us that she does not think that Charlie is using here. And I think this episode sort of underlines that, the fact that he doesn't get the statue back from Sawyer. So it's not about the drugs. It's about, like, the vengeance.
It's about Locke.
Yeah.
Making Locke look stupid.
I wanted to make him look like a fool.
So anyway, if you have ideas, more ideas about Charlie, or maybe what Sawyer and Rose and Bernard talk about when they hang out in their show, which sounds much more fun than the show we're actually watching, you can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. You can check out our website, stormpodcast.com, for all the latest updates on our calendar. You can tweet at us, @stormpodcast. And that is all the ways which you can contact us. We'll talk about Libby in the storm.
Excellent. That means it's time for the call. Neil, what happened this week on the island?
Oh boy, did lots happen. The Long Con. This episode is directed by Roxanne Dawson. It was written by Leonard Dick and Stephen Maeda. It aired on February 8th, 2006, and it takes place on day 57 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn about Sawyer's relationship with Cassidy, which was both his most successful relationship and his most successful con. On the island, someone comes out of the jungle and attacks Sun, which raises the general anxiety level of the entire camp, especially Ana Lucia, who, as we're reminded this week, is still building an army, I guess. They're just not talking about it very loudly. Sawyer and Charlie bond over being disliked. Jack and Locke talk about their trust issues, leading Locke to enlist Sawyer's help in hiding the guns when Jack and Jin come looking for guns after Sun's assault. Elsewhere, Hurley attempts to cheer up Saeed with a radio project. It kind of works. Either way, they find some tunes. We later learn that Sawyer has manipulated everyone, including Kate, in order to secure the possession of all the guns. Now he's the sheriff. It all ends with a big reveal that Charlie was the one who attacked Sun, and he did so both to help Sawyer and to make Locke look like a fool. Fun fact, Michael does not appear in this episode. This week's calm question. How much money would be enough money for you to participate in a long con? Would you say that it's over or under 600,000, which is what Sawyer steals from Cassidy?
But do you mean like participate, like pretend to be someone's...
Like you would be part of the con. Months? Yeah. Like how, what would be worth it to do like 6 months of con work?
Okay, but am I conning Kim Dickens, who plays Cassidy?
Maybe.
A dollar. I spent 6 months pretending to be Kim Dickens' girlfriend for a dollar.
That makes you a not trustworthy con partner.
How much
like,
would it
wait,
be?
Wait, she doesn't want any of the cut for the... This seems weird.
This is weird. You're the one who actually gives her the money at the end. How much would it be if you didn't know who the mark was?
Oh, okay, fair. $600,000. I mean, like, how much money would it take for me to be able to go to an island and drink mojitos until I go toe up? Because that's
probably about 600K. Yeah.
Great. 600K it is.
Mine's probably lower.
Yeah.
First of all, it would kind of be fun, right? To do the long con.
I mean, maybe.
Con someone?
Except for the part at the end where you destroy someone's life.
Well, I mean, but it's also the thrill like a roller coaster where at any point if it goes wrong, you could never be able to, you know, be seen in that state or country again.
It's also like the ultimate improv where it's like if something does go wrong, you have to think your way out of it very quickly.
Yes.
Exactly. I would do it for half of Joanna's. I would do it for 300K.
Okay. I think 600K feels about right.
Cool, a little over half a million.
But, oh, Dave, here's my
Dave
caveat.
Is probably right. My threshold's probably lower. That's okay. I'm being real.
If people were like, all you need
someone.
To do is lie for 6 months and then you get $300,000, I would be like, absolutely.
Yeah, but
like,
if a lie involves like sleeping with them and living with them and like pretending to love them, like that's it. That's
well,
I mean, $300,000 is still the most expensive prostitute I could possibly be. So it still works.
Over 6 months, though? I mean, I don't know what that averages out per hour.
I mean, we could use like the Pretty Woman scale, and I still think that's not going to make it to $500,000.
All right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
No, so
somebody,
I guess
somebody do the math.
The caveat is if it's the sexier the conning, the lower the number. Like, if I have to go, like, con Mike Bloomberg out of $1 million, then it's going to have to be $1 million or higher. Like, but yeah, if I'm conning beautiful women out of their shitty husband's money, it's right lower.
Okay,
interesting.
According to my math, there's 4,380 hours in 6 months. So, you say $300,000, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes you a $68 an hour hooker.
It also means that you made $300,000 for half a year's work, which is a lot of money when you say it like that.
Like I said, Pretty Woman rates are $3,000 for 6 days.
That's $500 a day. Divided by 24. Why are we doing math on the podcast?
Because we're trying to figure out if we're whores or if we're con men.
We're trying to find out if we're Julia Roberts. That's $20 an hour.
I'm trying to find out if I'm Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman or if I'm Julia Roberts in Ocean's 12. I don't know which is true.
Sure.
Which Julia Roberts are we? Anyway, we're talking about Lost, talking about a long con.
Yeah. I feel like the answer is we would all do it for lower if it's fun and sexy like Sawyer does it.
I mean, yes. Like I said, if it's Kim Dickens, yes. If it's Cassidy, yes. I'm a big, I'm a huge Kim Dickens fan. She rules. So
yeah, she's great.
It'd be like a reverse auction if it was a Kim Dickens con where we'd all be just lowering our prices.
I will pay you $10 to let me con you.
Please just let me con this person.
The thing I love about Kim Dickens in this, though, okay, so Cassidy, I'll just say that Cassidy is one of my favorite. Kim Dickens is one of my favorite guest stars on Lost, period. And Kim Dickens, if you guys are not, like, familiar with her byline, people know her best probably from Deadwood, Fear of the Walking Dead, Friday Night Lights. There was just a while where I feel like, well, this is true.
She was on everything.
She was, like, the that guy of TV.
Yeah. Yeah, but people would just be like, oh, you need someone great? Get Kim Dickens. Anyway, the thing that I love about her in this part, in this episode, because, like, we believe that Sawyer actually fell for her, right? Like, that's what we're meant to
believe.
Yeah,
right? He definitely seems to struggle with taking all of her money.
Okay, so what we've talked about on this podcast before is how this is sort of like a do-over from an earlier episode, the season 2 premiere. Right? Adrift? Or is that season 2, episode 2? Anyway, the episode Adrift.
Who can remember? The first three episodes are basically one big episode.
No, Adrift is 2, because the first one is Man of Science.
Oh, Man of Science, Man of Faith. Yeah.
Okay, so season 2, episode 2, Adrift, was initially supposed to be a Sawyer episode, and they filmed the flashbacks, and this was supposed to be the Tampa job that he talks about in season 1. And we talked about this at length in the Adrift episode, so I won't retread it too much, but basically, like, all we know about the Tampa job is from, like, some set photos, because they've never released what those flashbacks were going to be. But it's fun. Once you know and you rewatch Adrift, you can tell that those cutaways were kind of supposed to be the Sawyer flashbacks instead of Michael flashbacks. But we don't know exactly what the Tampa job was or why it didn't work in a way that they wanted to cut it from the episode, but we can assume that it was probably a pretty similar plot line to this one, because Kevin Dunn, who plays Gordy, who's Sawyer's associate in this episode, played his associate in the Tampa job episode. So, like, I think it was going to be a similar storyline, just set in Tampa that Sawyer falls for Mark and feels conflicted about conning her. The difference is, or a difference is, besides the like jaunty floral Miami wear or Tampa wear that they are, you know, that they have on that episode, is that the actress that they had playing the Mark is this actress named Jolene Blaylock, who is perhaps best known for being on Star Trek Enterprise. But she, if you compare her to Kim Dickens, which, like, listen, I don't really want to get into, like, objective hotness or whatever, but I'll just say this. The Jolene Blaylock was voted the 10th sexiest woman in the world in 2003 by FHM. That's the kind, and she's a former model. Like, that's the kind of sexual allure that this actress has, which is maybe, like, I don't want to sound judgmental, but maybe like a bit more of an obvious allure, right? Whereas Kim, I love this, like, for Kim Dickens, who is like a beautiful woman, like absolutely beautiful, but just in a different way that makes Sawyer's affection for her like mean more, I think, in the long run. Did I stumble my way through that?
You'd say that she's beautiful in a more grounded way and less of a Victoria's Secret runway model way.
It makes me like Sawyer more that this is the woman who like stole his heart for a time versus FHM sexiest woman of 2003 or whatever, you know.
And it really does sort of explain a little bit about Sawyer in that he is sort of attracted to someone who challenges him, you know. Sawyer likes a challenge. He likes a problem. He likes to be able to solve a problem. And I think she presents like a very real sort of intellectual foe to him, where at the beginning, she's obviously extremely aware of the I mean, it looks for a while like she's a really good, intellectual foe for him, until the very end, I guess. But even that is kind of sad. Like, she's so good at it that it makes him sad that he is screwing her over at the end, which is hard to do to somebody like Sawyer, who we're also watching on the island just be a complete dick about everything, you know? So I like that.
Because it's not T'Pol, sexy T'Pol, who I never would have believed could have gotten one up over on Sawyer, I think this performance, because it's so grounded, there's a lot more tension there. Like, in the last scene where she's like, I want to try the long con, and she's like, and I like have some money, before we get the reversal with Gordy that this is, you know, Sawyer's long con, there is like a couple of moments where I'm like, is she conning him? And I think that that's 100% because of the performance, because it's not in the script. The script plays per, I think, a lot straighter than the actual performance does, but because of that, it's like it plays as a real chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me of Annette Bening in The Grifters, right? Like, it's just like I don't like comparing women this way, but there's just like an intelligent beauty involved in Kim Dickens that, like, yeah, just makes you really feel like who's cunning whom here. And the answer always across every single instance in this episode is it's Sawyer. But you know, and the cutaways from her to Kate, like the through line, I guess, from Cassie to Kate, you kind of like see the connection between those two women in a way that I'm not convinced we would have seen with this other woman, though, you know, that's unfair to say because we didn't see her performance, but like, I really like it. I like there's one particular cutaway from Cassidy to Kate, where she comes over and like, teases him about his tent or whatever, like that is particularly sharp that I really like. So there you go. Cassidy Phillips fan.
Good flashback for Sawyer, even while the island story. This is also interesting. This is one of the few times that our flashback and our island story are, you know, informing each other. But usually we get the reveal in the flashback before we get the reveal on the island, which makes Sawyer walking out of the jungle with the gun, like, actually work. It's almost like the flashback allows you to think that you're getting ahead of that con, so it distracts you from the con that's happening on the island. because up until Sawyer, you know, walks out with the gun, there's very little indication that he's the one playing the con, because they play each one of his interactions so, like, purely. Like, when he's talking to Kate, we're like, why don't you two fuckers kiss? When he's talking to Locke, it's like, are these guys gonna, like, make a truce just to, like, get back at Jack? And then you're never waiting to, like, see how Sawyer's manipulating people because he seems so reactive and charming. I think I like it. I mean, it does make it so when he walks out and he makes the huge and fantastic speech about, you took my stuff and now I'm the sheriff.
She took my shaving cream. Now I took all your guns.
Exactly. and then, you know, also, Kate's, revelation that he just needs to, like, he wants people to hate him, and his saying that, you know, he always cons and she always runs. And then we go back to get the reveal of his, con against Cassidy, which is, I think I like it. It's using your flashback structure to, I guess, up and plus the pacing of the island, mm-hmm. which in general is just them walking back and forth between two locations. But it's almost like the episode does a really good job on the island stuff of making sure that the audience, thinks that the con that they're watching is in the flashback until, like, the very last moment. Or at least it worked for me in a rewatch.
I mean, I think some of our first time listeners were like, well, because of the title of the episode, I kind of, like, figured out what was going on the island. And I think that that's fair, but Sawyer is so good. And I think the strongest thing that might tip the episode's hand is in that scene with Cassie where she's like, what's a long con? And he's like, it's getting someone to do something, like, to ask you to do something, like, making them think it's their idea, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he says, it gets you to ask them to do something like it's their idea, but it's your idea. And then, like, right then, Locke is like, right after that, Locke is like, will you help me move the guns?
I need you to help me move the guns. Yeah.
Right. Or Kate's like, I need you to go talk to Locke. You're just like, Sawyer, so good at your job, man.
I do like the ending, though, because it's a really interesting look at how Sawyer views himself. And the flashback does a really good job of informing us of where this viewpoint came from. You know, Sawyer is, he thinks he's a bad guy. He thinks that he's never done anything good in his life, even though we've actually kind of seen him do good stuff on the island. But he's very convinced that he's a bad dude. And the flashback really reinforces that, because you see him in a moment where you could see that go the other way with Cassidy. Like, you could see him running away from old Gordo, old the dad from Transformers. and running away to an island. Like, you really sort of see it in his performance in that moment, where he's kind of almost into the idea of the island, drinking mojitos, that is, not the island of mystery. So I think that's really, it's a really powerful ending. I think the Charlie thing feels okay. It feels sort of tacked on to me. But I guess somebody had to be, you know, he had to be, somebody from the camp had to be the one who he used to go get Sun. And, I guess Charlie's reasoning is fine. I don't know. I feel like that moment is way better for our understanding of Sawyer than it is for our understanding of Charlie. That last little piece there, the last little reveal at the end.
Yeah, because I think, well, not only did we just spend a whole bunch of time, like you were saying, with the flashback, like, establishing this self-view, we kind of, that hasn't been happening as successfully with Charlie. Maybe it's because either, one, Charlie's is way more complex, as we're learning through listener emails, or two, there's just, like, a Josh Holloway charm that I'm willing to watch him be conflicting, and then if he smiles, I kind of forget that I, like, had a problem with him. That doesn't exist for Charlie, unfortunately.
It's almost like he's a really good con man.
I know.
He cons the audience.
One of my favorite looks he gives actually is not even a smile. It's maybe it is. Oh, there's so many good smiles this episode from Sawyer. But Jack and Locke. I don't know. Jack's off doing something. He's going to go do something. And Sawyer gives this look to Kate, this, like, really sly look. And then it cuts to them, like, looking for evidence about Sun in the jungle, right? Like, they're like, we'll go do it, you know? But, like, he gives Kate this sly look, and you don't see the scene, but I just feel like the scene is Kate being like, Sawyer, we should go look for Sun. And he's like, what a great idea. Glad you thought of it.
He's like, gotcha, Freckles.
Oh, so we can, like, oh, okay. Also, how do we feel about, I have some nickname questions.
It's a mixed bag in this episode.
Like I said, Sawyer, if he smiles, you forget about a whole bunch of stuff.
It's a hard mixed bag. I mean, like, I'm not touching Tokyo Rose. We all know that, like, his racial
nicknames
are bad. But I gotta say, the fact that he calls Cassidy Dimples and Kate Freckles, I really like. I think that's a great through line. But I think maybe his worst nickname, and I don't mean like politically, I just mean like creatively, is calling Anna Lucia Honolulu. That's what he calls her. And I'm like, were you even lazy. Trying, bud? Like, what the fuck was that? Honolulu? Like, no.
So if he met, like a really pretty woman with a mole on her face, do you think he would call her Mole or call her Cindy Crawford?
He would call her mole, 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 mole.
I mean, if we're being honest, I don't understand how Sawyer is letting this whole Anna Lucia shot Shannon in the jungle thing go without a nickname. Where's the gun happy nickname for Anna Lucia?
I'm going to say a nickname, and I don't know if he said it yet.
Okay. I'm getting ready to write down a time code. Here we go.
Rambina? Has he not called her that yet?
Oh, forgot about that one. That,
it's so bad. I feel like he calls her that earlier this season when they're like kidnapped or whatever by her.
Sawyer's nicknames. Rambina. Oh, there's a whole thing.
Thank you, internet.
Okay, while you look that up, I have a quick game to play with you guys.
Calls her what?
So he says to Kate, "You run Icon, right?"
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So now I would like you to come up with one verb for some other characters on Lost. What
Jack,
does
Jack fixes?
Jack fixes? Okay. Yep. What does Locke do?
Believes.
Whatever he wants.
What one word. What does Charlie do?
Pines.
Only pines.
He does.
Maybe for heroin, maybe for Claire. It's hard to say. What does Saeed do?
Oh, Saeed broods.
Oh, broods is better than tortures.
Tortures.
Himself tortures himself.
Yeah. Anybody.
He's constantly torturing someone.
I think that's all I got for right now. But
damn, Hurley really gets so many nicknames.
Oh, that's true.
Wow.
There.
Well, it's because anytime he's talking to Hurley, you know it's probably, or it, the chances are it's not like a super gravity heavy scene. They have to be super serious.
Did I miss the one where he called Jack Dr. Quinn in Solitary?
Yes.
I don't know. Some of Slayer's nicknames, as we've discussed, are problematic, but some of them are really funny.
Are really good. It's true. Freckles
sums up a lot of Sawyer.
Freckles is just iconic, you know what I mean? So
yeah, it right up there with Sassafras.
Okay, it doesn't say when he calls her that.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So we'll just what? Have to Rambina, right?
Oh, Rambina. Yeah, it doesn't say.
We'll assume that it has been done. If not, we just spoiled.
Sorry, we just
one
spoiled
of many spoiled
Rambina
Sawyer nicknames
for you. All right, let's talk about what happens to Sun, and how much we hate Sawyer and/or Charlie for doing this.
Yeah, because like, what did Sun ever do?
Yeah, I feel like I'm really pissed at them when I get a good look at Sun's, not only Sun's head wound, but also like Jin's frantic terror around it. I'm very mad at these two guys for this bullshit. So did they have to go that hard? What do you think?
In terms of, well, from what I understand, he pulls her away and then she gets up and runs and falls and hits her head, right? I mean, so in that sense, I don't feel bad for them, but also Like, I don't know. So the red herring in all this is Vincent, right? Because Vincent shows up right before Charlie does. It's like the others. So did Vincent, like, was he just like hanging out with Charlie and he doesn't know any better?
I'm sorry, are you trying to make Vincent complicit in this con?
Oh yeah, Vincent was definitely in on it.
Vincent's just a very good boy.
I'm just saying he's the red herring of trying to figure out like what's important in a show where they show everything, so you're like, hey, maybe that's important. Vincent showing up before Sun gets taken is like the red herring of the episode because Vincent's not part of the con. But everything else sort of like, doesn't that kind of line up with, in terms of the orders of the scenes, we see the Jack and Charlie thing and then we're off to step one?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely some dumb shit that Charlie would do. Like,
that makes sense.
I mean, I guess the fact that the head wound was like quasi self-inflicted, not really, but like, you know, collateral damage from this, but like still throwing a bag over a woman's head and dragging her off into the jungle,
it's extremely traumatizing. It is definitely something that neither of those men have ever thought about, though.
It wouldn't take you very long, I think, to come up with a better way to freak everybody out that isn't, let's throw a bag over Sun's head and drag her into the jungle. Like, I'm sure there's other ways to, you know, they could have lit something on fire, although Charlie used that one recently.
Yeah, last week.
Like I said, it's some dumb shit Charlie would do.
Well, it's her because she's in the garden, not
sure,
because
she's
it's Sun.
Isolated. All the time.
It could have been
when she's working in the garden. She's by herself.
It could have been Scott Steve.
They could have grabbed Jin. He was probably off fishing.
They would not have grabbed Scott Steve. Okay, here's a few thoughts. I feel like Charlie went after Sun, and it was probably Sawyer's idea to do so, because she is maybe one of the least well-muscled individuals, as Sawyer intimated. If I were Charlie, I would not want to try to drag Jin anywhere.
That's true.
But I might want to try to drag Sun. But she's also extremely well-liked. I think that matters. You know what I mean? Like, Scott, mm-hmm. I don't think people would get so excited about defending Scott Steve as
it's
they
true.
Do about Sun.
I also think that he knew, Sawyer knew at least. I don't know if, it's hard to tell how much of this was Charlie's idea, other than Charlie was just wanting to be in on it to piss off Locke. But like from a Sawyer's perspective, he's like, okay, well, who can I rile up that might get to Jack, that might get Jack to open to go for the guns? And Jin is actually a good candidate because Jin is like, at this point, a fairly calm actor, you know, and Jin has finally chilled out and he and his wife are having a, you know, good time with their nice tent, chilling with his shirt off. So Jin's sort of one of those people who, when he starts arguing with Jack, he actually gets somewhere with Jack. Whereas if it was, I don't know, there's a bunch of people it could be that Jack would be like, yeah, don't worry about it. It's fine.
A dramatic reenactment of the Ocean's 11 style planning of this event.
Right.
Charlie goes, we have to piss off Jack. What if we take Kate? And then Sawyer
sure.
goes, think again, Ringo, or something like that, right? You know, like, don't, you're not touching my girl. But also, Kate will punch the shit out of you.
Sure. So. Kate would kick Charlie's ass. Jin would yeah. kick Charlie's ass. Bernard yeah. would probably kick Charlie's ass. Rose would probably kick Charlie's ass. So yeah, it's pretty much just Sun. And it's only Sun. When she's not looking.
Yeah. Because if she had you know, 2 seconds on him, she would have kicked his ass too. I'm
sure.
pretty sure that like everyone, including Claire, could probably kick Charlie.
Yeah. The problem for Sawyer is that he only has Charlie to work with. It's, you know, you only have the clay that you're given to mold into a great con. So like if he had a Mr. Echo per se on his side, he could have taken anybody, but it's Charlie. So.
Yeah.
Not only that, no, I feel
and
like
Charlie already stole the baby once, so we can't do that again.
He's like, I think I could take the baby, and Slayer's like, yeah, that's a rerun.
Yeah, we know you can take the baby.
No more lighting the jungle on fire, no more stealing the baby, sorry. People are gonna know who that is immediately.
Those are your signature moves. Mm-hmm. Charlie's like, I could take Vincent. Sawyer's like, could you though? Not sure.
Is anyone going to notice
that the dog's gone?
The Vincent kidnapping just had already been going on for 12 hours and nobody noticed. So he's like, fuck, I guess son then.
Or Charlie was actually chasing Vincent and he came up on son and he's like, oh, shit.
He's like, what do I do? Got this black bag. Might as well. He's really going to black bag that dog.
Poor Vincent.
That's only funny in my head. No, he's fine. I don't think he's aware necessarily of the emotional strife of everybody going on. He's probably like licking Saeed's depressed hand whenever he like leaves it by his side.
Yeah, when he's not smashing coconuts.
I have a follow up. I have something that follows up on what we were talking about last week. Do you want to hear it? Here it goes. You know how we were talking about how like draping tarps on your tent is like a a way forward towards sexy times.
Yeah, tarping.
It's a good first date.
Tarpon and goopin and tarpon. Did you notice that Charlie's lame little pup tent is made of like blanket? Like he doesn't even have a tarp.
They ran out of tarps for Charlie.
His tent, like, well, A, no one's going to fucking help him make that tent. B, it's such a sad little pup tent. And C, it's made of blanket where there was a monsoon that hit this episode. Charlie's entire tent is a lake now.
On an island of infinite tarps, Charlie is the man with a blanket.
Without a tarp.
Nobody wants to tarp Charlie Page. Not right now, anyway.
I did like that we have a tarp freshwater bin on the beach now, because I almost asked last week, but didn't probably because Michael's not around to keep bringing up engineering. But wasn't like a whole thing of the caves was like that's where they had their water and they were going to make showers. I assume there's a whole tarp solution.
There's like 20 people living in those caves thriving right now, and we're just never visiting them because it's like Steve and like all the other nameless.
That's where the army's being trained.
Oh, you know what would be a really good show that we're not watching? What if it's Steve and like the ghost of Scott? What if Steve is being haunted by Scott?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
He like talks to Scott like it's like, you know, like, I can't think of a good example of that trope where someone's haunted and only they can see the ghost. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like a real fun slapstick comedy with Steve Scott. Scott and Steve right. and Scott.
And whichever one the dead one is, it's also been being manipulated by Jack's dad.
Oh, great.
So it's like a ghost long con where Jack's dad is trying to get Scott to get Steve to do something to Jack. I don't know. I'm not really
Scott
sure where
Steve.
It goes.
Steven and Scott, love it. Love
and rugby
it.
Shirt.
last thing we haven't talked about this episode is Depressed Saeed and the Hurley radio what's not. Did you guys know that low-level radio waves bounced off the ionosphere before this? Because I think that's what I learned in this episode.
Yeah, I think I learned the phrase ionosphere from this episode when I first watched it. Yeah.
It reminds me of Contact. No? Okay.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. Maybe it's something about the radio shape. But yes, I also got that feeling. And it also, that storyline includes one of my favorite references of the episode, which is the amazing album Nielsen Schmilson and Lime in the Coconut, which Curly brings up to Saeed. So, once again, I was going to put that as like Hatch music, but they decided on Purple Rain a couple episodes ago. Now I'm really regretting not having a Lost-centric episode where I get to mention Nielsen Schmielsen.
I've heard you talk about that album so many times. And I don't mean in a jerky way. I just mean that like I know that that's an important album to you. I know Lime. You put the Lime in the Coconut from that's on the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack, right?
Oh, maybe.
I believe so. Yes.
That's how I know. I know who Harry Nielsen is. I don't know that. I don't listen to that album, but it is a great song.
And fantastic song.
Saeed did not appreciate Hurley's great joke. He was too busy.
Saeed is just not in the mood right now.
No. Really shucking nuts.
His girlfriend of like 4 days was murdered in the jungle.
No. The love of his life of 4 days.
And now everybody's talking about gun control.
No, the show I want to see is the alternate universe spinoff where Shannon and Saeed get off the island. Like right around now, right before she gets shot by Ana Lucia, and they have to have a relationship. I just feel like that wouldn't go well. I just feel like there's some hurdles there for.
It's just the end of The Graduate for like a decade. The thing
is, them in the U.S. immigration office being like, and here we are for 4 years.
Fuck. I do feel like Ana Lucia. Okay, two questions about Ana Lucia. Number one, does making a Scott Steve joke or a mistake make you like officially part of the tribe? Like, if you have confused Scott for Steve, you are like fully part of the group.
That's how you know your tent is done. Like, you finish your tarps, and then you make your Scott Steve mistake, and then you're in the homeowners association on the beach.
You get a nickname from Sawyer. Everything happens right for you.
Yeah.
Someone tells you about the horse.
Oh, man, the horse.
You guys hear there's a horse running around out there?
I sat up on my couch. I was laying down watching this episode, sat straight up and went, horse? When Sawyer's like, Jack's going to go find that horse of yours and mount up a cavalry or whatever.
Horse? Okay. And then if you had made the life decision, as Ana Lucia has, to strap a large stick to your side, that's like, let's say the length of your entire leg,
mm-hmm.
would you be able to complete your don't fall down 2020, intention? If you were walking around with a large stick just dangling from your hip.
I mean, it's like constantly having a crutch on you.
Oh, you think it would help your don't fall down?
Yeah, it's like having three legs.
Okay, what do you think, Dave?
I mean, maybe you could use it as a walking stick, but also I'm pretty sure Ana Lucia's "Don't Fall Down" 2004 is not going well.
Yeah,
she fell out of the sky.
She's also trying. There, all of these people fell down.
Death straight down out of the sky.
She's also trying to form an army on an island. That feels like a recipe for falling down, at the very least.
Yes. A long metaphorical fall.
Yes.
All right, it's time for the land of many corners and moments as we close out the calm section with some reoccurring segments. New one this week, as I hinted to up front. Let's start there. Joanna, would you like to explain the jungle of Kistri?
Okay, patent pending. I'm not sure that that's what we're going to call this segment, but that is my favorite submission that we've had so far. So in our Patreon Slack, in the group chat there about this episode, one of our listeners, Lauren, was talking about like all the people that she wanted to have kiss in this episode. And then she suggested, like someone suggested it should be a regular segment that we should talk about who we want to have kiss in this episode, blah, blah. So before we officially make this a recurring segment, I do need to check with the hosts of the Buffering Cast, because they every week give out something called the Sexual Tension Award, and this is a little bit too close to their territory for my comfort, so I need to check with them to make sure this is okay. I'm sure it will be, because they are very pro-kissing. You might remember one of those hosts, Jenny Owen Youngs, was in a season one episode, and she wanted to do like sort of a weekly hunk rating, so I feel like Jenny will be very pro us talking about kissing.
The Jungle of Kistery.
The Jungle of Kistery moment, but my
let's just call it, why aren't more people making out on this hot island show?
I can find you all of the name suggestions in a second, but an idea, and this is sort of like copping off the Sexual Attention Award, but like to we each pick one submission, and then maybe our listeners can vote on who they think should be kissing in this episode. No?
Sure.
Yes?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, this this episode seems a little bit easier than future episodes, but yeah, maybe okay, we'll want a lot. Maybe there'll be a lot of people to kiss in the future episodes.
Really, really quickly, I would like to read this. This thread comes from Chris. in our Slack who came up with a bunch of different ideas for what this should be called. Lost in the Moment. Kiss of Mystery, Jungle of Kistery, Kissity Clack. What Kate Kissed. Kiss and Tell. Locking Lips. Hatch After Dark. Thirst Time on an Island. Don't Ever Tell Me Who I Can't Kiss. I think that's it. So I still like Jungle of Kistery Moment.
What about Thirst Hatch?
Yeah, it's Thirst Hatch. Shout out to the Thirst Aid Kit podcast. What's yours? Well, Neil, you only get one. What do you gotta pick?
Well, I definitely think Locke and Jack should kiss in the beginning. They're having a very intense conversation about trust. But like, what if that went and took a left turn at the beginning of the episode? Yep, that's it. It's probably always going to be Locke and Jack for me. I don't know why.
I mean, that's a really good one to just pick every week. I'm already on your side.
Okay. Dave?
I'm going to make an argument that also came up in the Slack, but I'm going to take it and voice it because I think for this particular episode, this makes the Jungle of Kistery important. There should be a Kate, Jack, Sawyer throuple. Just like one big three-way kiss.
Yeah, love a good throuple.
Just kind of like, just get it all out in the open. Maybe make Anna Lucia watch it. Just there's like, you don't want to be part of this. This is the core throuple of Lost.
It's okay. Anna Lucia doesn't want to kiss them. Well, she wants to kiss Kate, but she doesn't want to kiss anyone else. Okay. So I was going to pick, if none of you picked it, I was going to pick the super obvious Kate and Sawyer soaking wet, because like there's a part where they get like trapped in the rain and they're super wet and they're under the tarp and they're looking at each other and stupid Sun has to interrupt it with her
damn
traumatic screams. No,
I forgot Sun and Vincent.
Sun like majorly con blocks Locke. No, but I will take a page from Sawyer's book and I will say Locke and Claire.
He's just sleeping by her to provide some extra safety. She asked him to come down.
Does he call him Lucky Boy or something like that? It's not good, probably. Whatever it is. Anyway. All right, so we've got Jack and Locke, Kate Sawyer, and Jack.
He calls him Hoss.
Locke and Claire.
Well, he calls him Johnny Locke in this episode.
Oh, Johnny Locke. I think that's what he says. Johnny Locke has his needs or something like that. I will look in our Slack for listener submission, but I will just say every week if listeners want to submit their candidate, then we can have four candidates going our three picks and then something that the listeners picked. And we'll have maybe like a poll up on Twitter. I miss the old most 2004 thing poll thing that we used to do on Twitter. So we might bring that back for this. But once again, I got to clear this with the buffering people because this is a definite ripoff of their bit. So we'll see if they're okay with it.
Can't our show be as horny as their show? Well, I guess actually with actual horns. No, it can't. Never mind.
All right. So that is our new segment, Jungle of Kistery Moment.
Excellent. Let's do some old favorites then. Neil, do we have a Giacchino corner this week?
Yeah, well, we have a Giacchino corner that goes with our Jungle of Mystery moment.
Ooh.
Because it's all about the music that Hurley and Saeed hear at the end. And Hurley says, you know, Saeed's like, it just bounce off the ionosphere and could come from anywhere. And Hurley's like, or any time. Eyebrow raise. And the station that is playing music is playing Glenn Miller. And fun fact, not so fun fact about Glenn Miller is that he is a musician who was never seen again after his plane disappeared in bad weather during World War II. So there's no real Giacchino corner, but I thought that Glenn Miller fact would be interesting.
This is where, dear listener, I wish I could tell you that in the storm I would be able to tell you when Glenn Miller showed up on the island. But unfortunately, that just has to be headcanon for you going forward. But wouldn't that be great? Just like, where's that sad oboe coming from?
Yeah, well, Glenn Miller is actually one of the bodies that they found in the cave.
Oh, fair, fair.
Spoiler
yeah.
alert.
The Glenn Miller cave.
Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey together forever.
This whole show is about finding Glenn Miller. I'm sorry, that's just what it is.
I'm sorry. It's obviously Glenn Miller and Amelia Earhart together last forever and night.
Yep.
Right.
Great stuff. Love it.
The fourth season is Amelia Earhart is lost, and the sixth season is Glenn Miller is lost. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Cool. Our Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Sun, who, while fleeing her captors, takes a spill, gets a nice headache. That's the nice way of putting that type of head injury that my mom used to say when I was a little boy that fell down. Because it's like, yeah, headaches? No?
Sure.
Just me? Just, all right, cool.
More of a head wound.
Head eggs? Is that what you're
saying? Because it swells like an egg. Like
a
giant
egg.
You get an egg on your head. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. Good. All right, sweet. For a second there, I was like, cool, Mom. Thanks, Liz.
My mom used to say, you get a lump on your noggin.
Oh, I mean, that's good, too. Yeah. That's, man, the more, maybe I should have grown up slightly more towards the middle of America.
I wish it was more Midwestern.
I know, just a little bit more. I just like a few more casseroles. Joanna, what's our accent corner for this week?
All right, so Kimberly Jan Dickens, star of Deadwood, Treme, House of Cards, Fear of the Walking Dead, etc. Something we haven't mentioned that we should mention really quickly in the com is that in the diner scene, with Gordy and Sawyer, Kay's mom is there. Diane is their waitress.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that sets us in Iowa. So we are in Iowa. So I'm not sure where Cassidy is supposed to be from. Is she supposed to be from Iowa? Unclear. But, this leaves us with some questions, which is this. A, what accent do you think Cassie is supposed to have? And B, do you have any thoughts about where Kim Dickens might be from? Neil Miller.
I would guess it's got a little twang to it. Like, it sounds like an Oklahoma or a Nebraska type accent, like her natural accent. Mm-hmm. I don't know what she's... I don't think there is an Iowa accent. I mean, people in Iowa are free to email us and correct us, but I don't know if they're... I mean, it's like a Mountain West... Not even a Mountain West state. It's like a Plains state. So it's like, is there like a rural Illinois accent? I don't think there is. So that would be my feelings about Iowa. So I'm going to guess like one of the Dust Bowl states.
So you're saying like Nebraska,
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Okay. Yeah.
Ooh, that's actually really good. Because I was going to say she reads to me as somebody that like was maybe around southern, a southern sort of accent, but not like in a pure southern area.
Like she's from Florida.
Like either like a Florida or like a northern Missouri sort of thing.
Or like a Kansas. Yeah, Kansas is right near there, right?
Yeah, Kansas. Kansas is slightly more west, but I'll go Kansas because when you said Kansas, I pictured her in my head going, I'm from Kansas, and that looks right to me.
So the only thing I know about the Iowa accent is from the musical The Music Man, where they claim that some people pronounce Iowa Iowa, right? Like locals pronounce it Iowa.
What?
But maybe only at the turn of the century? Yeah.
Sure.
At the turn of the century.
Sounds very old-timey.
Locals used to say Iowa. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Anyway, no. Kim Dickens is like deep-fried southern lady. She's from Alabama.
Yeah. We would have been close with Florida.
She's
from Huntsville, Alabama. I think you could hear it most in Treme. I was trying to give you a little clue in there for you that she was on Treme. But yeah, she's a very southern lady. I love her. Okay. I love her accent.
So maybe that's just
because also she cooked, and her, watching her cook is like ASMR.
Yeah. Treme was good. I guess that's maybe she's her dropping it the accent. It sort of slips through a little bit.
I do want to mention really quickly two entries. This is not like a usual segment, but a book club, Lost Island Book Club segment, which is Locke is slipping through the book, The Incident at the Owl Creek Bridge, which is a novella, I think, by Ambrose Bierce, which do you guys know the story?
I've seen the Twilight Zone episode.
It was also a Twilight Zone episode. which, basically, this Civil War soldier dies. I think he's a Confederate soldier. He's about to die or whatever, and then he gets rescued and he walks, he does this long walk home, and all this stuff happens, and then it turns out that actually he was dying, and everything that happened in that walk or whatever was the time it took from him to like drop from the side of the bridge for his neck to snap with the rope. So there's been, it's a book that often gets referenced by people when they're trying to like come up with a crackpot theory for a TV show. I definitely wrote an article about this with an episode of The Walking Dead, because I definitely thought that Rick Grimes was dead, but he wasn't. I think people have done it with Westworld. So it's just one of those like TV theory books that comes up a lot. And then the other thing is,
it's a good book for deep thinking showrunners.
Yeah, exactly. and then do you want to talk about the book The Bad Twin, Dave?
This will be the only time this will be the first time we mention it on the podcast, but it's his first appearance in the show. It is a novel that you can buy and read, and it was released the first week of May of 2006, which is after this episode, as a part of the alternate reality game experience, The Lost Experience, which we should talk about in the storm if we want to bring that into the main part of the podcast while it was like broadcasting. It happened in between seasons 2 and 3. But it is a book that it was written by the guy that was sucked into the turbine and the pilot. All and right. That's Bad Twin. I believe his name was Gary. Yes.
Gary Troop, right? Yeah.
Gary Troop.
Oh, I just looked it up and now I see why we have to talk about it in the storm.
Yeah, we can't talk about Bad Twin in general in the column until it pops up for the last time, I think.
We have two ironic statement awards that I dropped in here. Do you guys want to pick one or do you want to do both?
Give it both. Why not?
All right, I'm going to read the first one and then Neil definitely has to read the second one. the first one goes like this. I don't need cheering up. Smashes coconut really aggressively. That's Saeed.
As it turns out, Saeed did need cheering up.
Did need
Whoa!
Cheering up.
All right.
That's where Ron Howard comes in as the narrator.
He did.
Okay, this one is from Sawyer. This is, well, hell, baby. With that kind of money, let's find an island somewhere and go drinking mojitos till we go toes up.
I just thought talking about being stranded on an island was ironic, right? It's meant to be ironic.
It is.
And they took his beer. the official Lost podcast was being released at this time, where you got to hear the showrunners talk about the episodes. This one I have pulled, it's another from the question and answer section, so it's not specifically about the Long Con, but it's another back and forth between Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof that reads funnier now. Here we go. Damon says, okay, Carlton, this is a good one because it references a quote that I'm...
I have a quick suggestion. I think you and Neil should do a dramatic reading.
A dramatic reading?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Hold on. Let's see.
You should be Damon then, Neil.
Oh, I would love to be Damon Lindelof.
You could start here at the top.
Okay, Carlton, this is a good one because it references a quote that I made, and maybe you can clean up my mess. This is asked by Pawn 5, Canadian version of TV Guide, January 28th to February 3rd issue, has one of the executive producers of Lost, Damon Lindelof. They actually spelled my name correctly here. That's very exciting to me.
I do like questions where you're referred to as Damien.
Yeah, that's true, Carl. answering.
I don't go by Carl. Sorry.
Answering a question of what the numbers mean, and here's the quote. That question will never be answered. I couldn't possibly imagine how we could answer that question. We will see more ramifications of the numbers and more usage of the numbers. And Pawn 5 goes on to write, there we have it, folks. The numbers will never be explained. So what's the point now?
Why would you say that, Damon? Why would you give such an incendiary quote? I mean, my God.
I can't imagine having ever said these things.
What were you thinking?
I must have been drunk.
Oh my God, exactly. You and Bodie Miller were out.
Yeah.
drinking together and
shooting guns,
skiing. Okay. I think what you meant was,
what did I mean?
I think what you meant, Damon, was that it's sort of an impossible question on one level to answer. I mean, some of the mysteries of this show are sort of like religious mysteries. Like, how would you explain, you know, the notion of God? I mean, you could take a stab at that answer. You can, but there may be a thousand different ways to answer that question. And I think that there's a certain mystical quality to the numbers that may not ever be explained. It doesn't mean that we don't understand their role, their significance, their importance, but you know that they're in certain parts of the storytelling of the show are embedded in mysteries that are just inherently unexplainable, and different characters will have different interpretations of what those ultimate mysteries mean. So in that sense, I think that that's probably what you meant.
It sounds like exactly what I meant. So thank you for clarifying that.
Oh, no problems.
I have a feeling that quote will be coming back to bite me in years to come.
It will. And dramatic reading.
Ron Howard, it will.
It will.
Of course it will.
We did it.
We did it.
That was The Calm, and we'll be back talking about spoilers and stuff for The Long Con right after this.
All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank some of our Patreon subscribers. These are the folks at the $10 level or above. They hang out with us. They watch movies with us. They are called our small council because we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast. And they are Sean Duane, Stacey Taxon, Debbie Denise, or Denise, Randy Allen, Elaine, Jen, Rich Lyman, Moira Burke, Rachel Matusik, Jeff Cooper, Stephen Fusco, Angela Flunker, Christopher Holmquist, Alicia Gressla, Elliot Goldbaum, Dharma Jess, Darth Fishius, Logan Wagner, Kevin Mullaney, Carol Blaine, and Monica Rickman. Thank you so much.
And I would like to add to those thanks with Ruby Durham, Tanya Shrum, Dennis Ramirez, Crystal Kirk, Josh Froschheiser, Rebels, Alyssa Scott, Quang Yu Liu, Liz Major, Brian Morawski, Randy Blash, Brittany Whimsy Riot, Sam Cohen, Kate Whitney, Amber Vickers, Shosav Delai.
You're definitely Shosav doing it, bud.
I mean, you get this one every time.
Yeah, I do. It's always wrong. All right, I'll do it again. Shosav O'Dolly, Patricia Delaney, Tim Wiseman, Carrie King, and Lauren Bree. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Christopher Bates, Steph Deal, Aubrey Iyer, Miranda Mooney, Elise Abschitz, Josh Brown, Victoria Stout, Kathy Schaberg, Lindsay Romaine, Grace Brown, A. Will, Ellen Rabin, Katie Truchon, Liz Roller, Rosie O, Billy Bosky, James Cooper, Tracy, John Lillystrom, and Callum Guy. Thank you all very much.
And we are back for The Storm. Joanna, I hear we have a Libby email.
We do. So this actually brings up a question that we'll get to eventually about the writer's strike. I kind of forgot that the writer's strike impacted Lost. Not this season, but I think it's season 4. But Matthew writes in, he says, "Hi, host, just some quick thoughts on Fire and Water. First of all, Matthew wants to say that I pronounced the word that describes being from Manchester incorrectly. So the word, he says it's Q rather than Q, Mancunian rather than Mancunian. I really think I said the first one, but maybe I didn't. Anyway, point being, I pronounced that word probably wrong. It's definitely not like the cat. All right. And then Matthew writes, "Secondly, some thoughts on Libby. I think I'm right in saying that we never got her full backstory because of the writer's strike. But even if we ignore her meeting with Hurley and the question of whether that is a coincidence or not, we still end up with her just happening to turn up at the right moment to give Desmond a boat. Equally, we have Abaddon's line, 'I get people where they need to be,' which sounds exactly like what Libby is doing for Desmond. So surely in the season 2 finale, we can conclude that Libby is working for Widmore to get Desmond to the island. Thoughts?" And, you know, maybe this is something we can bring up when we get to the season two finale, but it, I just wanted to remind us to be like thinking about that. But the thing about the the writer's strike is that it cut season four short, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And basically Libby shows up in the episode Meet Kevin Johnston, right? And that happened right before, which is when Michael, you're like, holy shit, Michael's back. And that happens right before the writer's strike. And then there were supposed to be two more episodes that season. And so a lot of people think that there was going to be a Libby, like that Libby's episode is going to be the next episode. There's some rumblings that maybe that was going to be a Rousseau episode, which we never like, well, we get Rousseau back in time later in the series. And then someone else is like, well, maybe that would have been a Charlotte episode because we never get a Charlotte flashback. We get like baby Charlotte, but we don't get a full Charlotte episode ever. So yeah, just some thoughts of like maybe they had planned to figure out that Libby thing and then the writer's strike happened and they were like, you know what? We just need to plow forward from here. But I love the idea that Libby, I don't think there's evidence for it in the text fully, but I love the idea that Libby is working for Widmore. I really like that.
Here's where that also lines up with Bad Twin and, last week's official podcast check-in where they were very into putting like the Widmore sign. The Bad Twin has a cast of fictional Widmores, but nevertheless are supposed to be like Widmores based on the Lost World Widmores, but like these like rich eccentric family who worked with the Hanzo Foundation, who, you know, are the basis for this mystery. But the narrative of Bad Twin is the lead detective guy, who's sort of like this hard-boiled sort of dude, is searching for the other Widmore twin so that their father can distribute the inheritance amongst the good twin and the titular bad twin, who ends up not being that bad. But it's the interesting thing is, like, a bad twin was part of the kickoff of the Lost Experience. The Lost Experience has a whole bunch of Widmore stuff, has a whole bunch of Hanzo stuff, so it actually wouldn't surprise me if Libby was tied to one of those characters this early on, and they just didn't know exactly how they were going to do it, but they did know that that connection was there, because they are planting stuff this far out for this like multimedia experience they're going to have. It ran from May 2006 to September 2006. For the most part, they're like websites that you had to log into, and people picking up the further research of Gary, the author, who wrote also the Valenzetti equation, which was supposed to explain the numbers. And then it's also funny that this week's official podcast poll was basically like, we're not going to explain the numbers, because at this point they had handed off the explanation for the numbers to the three different production teams that were handling the alternate reality experience and prepping it and getting it ready to go. So it's almost like on the podcast you could hear the like week that they were like, okay, you know what? We're going to give this to the alternate reality game, and we're going to give Bad Twin to the alternate reality game. We're going to put up a Widmore banner, and all these things, they're sort of building to the thing. But there is actually what they did is they released 7 interview clips with the author, not played by the stuntman who was sucked into the turbine, but by a different nameless actor who's playing the author, who's giving an interview about Bad Twin. And they released 7 parts that were labeled like blank of 9. So like 1 of 9, 2 of 9. And Javier Grillo Marswash said a couple years later, there never was the 2 missing pieces. It was just like a mystery upon a mystery. So my question to you guys is, as we, in between season 2 and season 3, this experience existed for people. It's not really replicable for us. However, if we want, I could try to like gather together some clips. Do we want to make some sort of Lost Experience stop on the storm?
Why don't we ask our listeners? Is that something they'd be interested
in? Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we will. Well, we just found so many reasons to do Twitter polls today. Make sure you're following us at Storm Podcast. And when you hear us contemplating doing the Lost Experience, maybe we will.
I have, speaking of things that happened outside the show, ARG style, did you guys know that shortly before, not a couple months before this episode aired, that both Cynthia Watros and Michelle Rodriguez were arrested together for drunk driving? And it sounds like they were racing on a Honolulu highway.
I did not know about the racing part.
Here, let me read this to you. I thought this was not going to be relevant or worth talking about until I read the story.
The Cynthia Watros, Michelle Rodriguez DUI story is like one of the most famous stories of Lost, but I somehow never knew about the racing part.
Yes. This is from The Smoking Gun, which this is the only time I've ever been to this website. But it says Rodriguez, 27, and Watros, 37, were nabbed minutes apart as their respective cars weaved along a highway linking Kailua and Honolulu. Yeah. So it sounds like they were street racing or definitely weaving through traffic. Which, fascinating.
Like, I feel conflicted about, because on the one hand, I'm like, okay, it's, you know, like Michelle Rodriguez, Fast and Furious. And that's kind of like cool they were doing that. But also, I've driven on those roads on Oahu, and like they're really scary and dicey in places. So that was very, I mean, not to sound so square, but that was very reckless of them. Like, if they had been doing it in a place where there was like no chance they were going to like fuck anyone else's lives up, then that's kind of like incredible. But Oahu's not the place to do that. I mean, that's the thing, is like, because they were not the only people to be to have a drunk driving incident.
Some trouble. That'll have to be a new corner. Is which Lost cast member got arrested?
Corner. I think Daniel Dick Kim also had an incident. I could be making that up, but maybe this is why when I saw Terry O'Quinn on Oahu, he was walking home from the supermarket, not driving. Maybe a bunch of them decided to no longer drive.
Terry Quinn's like, if you walk everywhere, you could be drunk all the time.
I mean, what's also true is that the Oahu cops are like extremely bored and forever looking for people to, like, you know, that there's some places where the cops are busy doing a lot of other things, and then there's some places like Oahu where they're like, welp, let's sit in this sugarcane field and wait till we see which assholes drive by too fast, sort of thing. So, anyway.
Yeah, I didn't know that story.
About the DUI?
Yeah, about the two of them together getting a DUI.
Well, the DUI is like why a lot of people think that they were killed off, like sort of
really
summarily at the end of this. Yeah, it's a debated, but yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, then it is relevant.
It's a very common theory that because they got a DUI and I think then
they both get shot.
Yeah, they were hard. It was like hard to like insure them or something like that, you know, or something, you know. And so then they just like got rid of them, I think. But there's, you know, conflicting evidence about that. We're going to talk about that at length on the episode where they die. I promise.
For our lock antagonist check-in this week, I actually have good news, guys. Mm-hmm. In our fantastic Slack, user, also by the name of Neil, we'll just say Neil T, because I don't want to dox anyone who has this much time and is dedicating to my fantastic show, has made me a nice little PDF that has, you know, a mission statement and, like, a little grid that separates some actions into antagonist behavior and protagonist behavior. The sheet is called John Locke Antagonist Behavior by Season. And it is great, and it is in our Slack, and I'm going to continue sharing on the Slack, and if I get permission, just straight out, maybe what I'll do is I'll tweet a redacted version up to where we are, just so you guys can see that I'm not alone on my crusade anymore. I'm building an army to fight the others.
There's a cult of antagonists, of antagonist sympathizers checking in.
We're just all, there's one black and there's one white, and we, you know, all praise the smoke monster.
I mean, in this episode, Locke, I think is for the most part trying to act in the good of the camp, right? He's trying to, the argument that Sawyer makes, that once the guns come out, they're never going back in is powerful for Locke. And I do think that he genuinely wants to just like calm everyone down at that point, or like just make sure that no one shoots themselves or each other. So I don't know if I would put anything that he does in this episode necessarily in the antagonist category.
So for the season two, on this spreadsheet, there are two antagonist behaviors and one protagonist behavior. The protagonist behavior is actually in this episode, which is Locke has a paternal influence for Claire. So that's a good season two Locke. Bad season two Locke is Locke triggers lockdown of the hatch to see what happens if the button isn't pushed, and then he smashes the computer despite Desmond telling him that the button is real.
I was wrong!
Well, see, and once we get to lockdown, we'll have to debate that, but I don't know if that's necessarily antagonist behavior either. That's just
season
curiosity.
Season 3 has the most antagonist behavior bullet points, so I'm excited to get to there, but I'm just happy that I infected one person to the point where they made a rel research documents with bullet points. That's just like, if that's the influence we could have on the world, absolutely, we'll do it.
I've fallen so far down a rabbit hole that I'm currently reading a very lengthy PDF with footnotes about and charts about Libby and the timeline and the DUI and the death of Libby. But here's a fun fact I just learned from this article. Cynthia Watrous got the part of Libby over Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Huh.
Hmm.
Right?
Huh.
Yeah.
I mean, good for her.
Oh, there's a whole Lostpedia article for traffic violations by the cast.
Right. Daniel Day Kim's on there, right? Can you check that right now just to make sure?
Yes. Daniel Day Kim was arrested in October of 2007. The following actors have been cited for speeding. Josh Holloway, Dominic Monaghan, Naveen Andrews, Ian Somerhalder, and Christian Bowman, who plays Steve. Even Steve was speeding.
Oh, Steve.
Oh, it was Scott. He's like, it wasn't me. It was Scott. The fuck?
They're like, really funny, Christian.
Yeah.
He was like, I said, Scott, take the wheel. And
Mr. Echo got a driving without a license. That was that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he also, yeah, man, everybody had a tough time.
It's very dicey on Oahu. I'm on their team. Like having driven all around that island, it is tricksy to not get, because like on some stretches there's just nothing, and it's a 2-lane road, and you're by yourself, and there's just nothing, and then your foot just sort of like starts to drift down on the gas, and you go over a hill, and all of a sudden there's a cop there. So I never got cited for speeding on Oahu, but I saw my uncle did while I was watching. Anyway, so I will be sharing this very long article about Libby. We're going to talk more about Libby later on.
Yeah.
But Jennifer Jason Leigh, that's fascinating to me. What an interesting choice. Okay. What else we got to do?
The radio signal came from 1940.
Yeah. Lindelof confirmed that later, that what them listening to Glenn Miller was actually a time travel radio signal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I still want sad oboe, and then Glenn Miller walks out. That talk myself into that. Okay.
I think we could pitch a limited series to ABC that's just, it's called, it's an anthology series. It's just called Lost, and then colon, and then the name of someone who's famous who's been lost.
Mm-hmm. But they always are just on the Lost Island.
Like, doesn't that's that the just show. Sound like, doesn't that sound like a show the History Channel already made?
Yes, like it's just, but we would like cast it
Lost.
Well.
But we'd bring Charlie back.
Oh, for sure. Charlie's in every episode.
Right.
But we do Lost, colon, Amelia Earhart. Lost, colon, Glenn Miller. I'm sure there are other people who have been lost. what was I going to say? Oh, the cliff thing, right? I'm not sure. I don't know how intentional it is, but I did like the moment where Locke's like, I assume, Jack, you're asking for the code because in case I fall off a cliff and you need it or whatever. And then Jack says something like, there are a lot of cliffs on this island, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole series ends with Jack throwing Locke off a cliff.
Wasn't that a reference to when Locke happened across Jack hanging off a cliff randomly in season 1?
I mean, there's a lot of cliffs on this island, Dave.
Yeah, so that's
their relationship falls over many cliffs.
it's a cliff island.
The show has a lot of cliffhangers, if you know what I mean. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, the only thing it's lacking is a man named Cliff.
Cliff Clavin. Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. I think that is the long con. Neil, mm-hmm. What are we doing next week?
Well, next week we're getting a long-awaited Saeed episode. It's called One of Them. And that's it.
This episode has one of the worst shots in the history of all of Lost. When I, in an earlier episode of this podcast, when I said there's a really bad effects shot later on, everyone in our Slack was in the storm section was like, oh, do you mean this? And it's a shot from this episode. So, yeah, get ready. Get hype.
Yeah, we're going to do some polygons.
Oh, it's going to be fun. I bet there's some color filters to show that we're somewhere else in the world.
Ooh, it's the Middle East, not Oahu, I promise.
Love that early 2000s television. All right, guys. Until next week, where can people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com and on Twitter at Rejects. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast. Based on this episode alone, I think there's going to be several important polls for you to vote on, and that's where you're going to do it.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. If you listen to my other podcasts, you might want to listen to Still Watching, where we're watching The Outsider, which I think is actually really good, and I'm very much enjoying it. So you should join us for watching that. Also, the podcast I was doing about my so-called life is officially over, but the last episode we released was sort of a surprise special bonus interview with my so-called life creator, Winnie Holtzman, where a letter from my co-host, Kristen Russo, made her cry on air. So if you want to hear us make a very nice lady named Winnie Holtzman, who created my so-called life, cry.
I like this new podcast where you make old creative women cry.
I love making people cry. Listen to the Boiler Room. There you go.
Tune in next week where I tell William Shatner he's fat.
Okay.
Well, that's okay because William Shatner's not nice. All right. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast and in your Slacks, urging you to not fall down.